Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And as I record this, the sky has decided to turn a dark shade. There's dirt blowing everywhere here in Denver. The wind is going nuts, and the temperature is dropping, and by tomorrow morning, we will have snow. The changing of the seasons can be a real gift. You know, if you're the type of person that can handle change and can handle rapid change, because it's going to go from 80 degrees to 30 degrees to 70 degrees, and that's what Denver does. It's a lot like my bipolar, as a matter of fact. you know, you don't know when it's going to come on. You don't know when it's going to happen. But how are you going to react to it when it does? Now, this is a little different because you can prepare for weather changes. You can get yourself ready for weather changes. But when that's in your mind, when it's in your heart, it's look out. You don't know what's coming. There might be some triggers that you know you should avoid. There might be some things thrust upon you that you don't want to see, you don't want to hear, because they bother you, because they set you off and down a negative path. But ultimately, who are you going to show up as? Who are you going to be when the cold weather hits? I'm going to be honest with you. When the weather gets strange, I get strange. I don't know why that is. I feel like it's, you know, maybe there's something that disrupts the signal. And, you know, I just can't think quite as straight. But, you know, what are you going to do? You wake up, you have a cup of coffee, you do what you got to do, you move on. You hope that tomorrow is going to be better. Tomorrow, there's going to be snow, and I'm ready for it. You know why? Because I got my scarf. Oh, today on the show, we have got Matt Scarfo. This is a great conversation. He's a fitness coach. He's a trainer, a motivator, and just all around a badass monster machine of a human being. And we had a very long conversation. So for you fans out there of the long ones, this one is double size. It is really, really thick. In fact, I think it was half me asking him questions and half him asking me questions. So if you like the guests, but you're not real crazy about the sound of my voice, guess what? Half of this is not going to be for you. But I suppose that would be what it's like all of the time for you. In which case, thanks. But I mean, come on. Do we really need to do this to each other? I think we both know the answer to that. And I think you know I love you for it. Now, this one can go all over the place, and it does. But if you can stick through until the end, there's some really, really meaty conversation to be had. And so I'm going to shut up now, and I'm going to let us get into this. And then I'm going to go and I'm going to get my winter stuff together so I can prepare for what's next.
Do
no. And I'm just grabbing the audio from this, so we're good.
Okay.
Yeah, the face-to-face works out real well for us to it just helps the communication, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that because I was thinking originally it was going to be just an audio call. So I'm wondering, and I feel like I need to talk to people rather than, you know, just some arbitrary voice on a phone.
Yeah.
So I was going to say, my kid's got this Ninja Turtle that's about 4 feet tall. I was going to put in the middle of my office just so I can talk to him while I talk to you. So I'm glad that I can see you because this is, I think it leads to a better conversation.
Yeah, I think it'll work out.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool.
Well, then that's it. Let's just get going. Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm all right. Things have been kind of nuts lately, but I guess all in the right ways. But okay. that's the funny thing about stress is that even if it's positive, it's still stress.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? And I don't think that your body or your brain really differentiate between the two. I think it's, I think our natural responses are very much the same, whether it's physical, mental, good stress or bad stress.
Yeah, completely. So where are you at right now?
So right now I'm in northwestern New Jersey in a little town called Blairstown. It's rural New Jersey. I think when most people think of New Jersey, they think of, you know, bricks, concrete, steel, and kind of like New York's armpit. And
yeah, yeah.
Out here, I'm a little bit closer to Pennsylvania, right next to the Delaware River. It's a nice little slice of heaven and, trees, farms. Out here in northwestern New Jersey.
Nice. Were you born there?
I was actually born in Queens, New York. Parents are originally from Brooklyn and moved us out here when I was about 5 or 6 years old, my brother and I. So lived out in New Jersey, bought this house with my wife a couple years ago.
Nice. So that's been most of your life in New Jersey.
Yes, for much of it that I can remember. Maybe I have a memory or two of the city, but for the most part, it's been New Jersey.
So tell me a little bit about what your experience has been, because you've been through a pretty gnarly existence.
Yeah,
where did that? Let's take it back, kind of pre that, because I do sort of like to lead up to how people kind of navigate getting to where they're going and how they end up where they are. So,
sure.
I mean, what kind of kid were you?
I was a good kid. I mean, as far as my family was concerned, you know, mom and dad were together, until she passed away, a couple of years ago. So, you know, married, typical family, me and my brother, like I said, we moved out here back in about 1985, 1986, preschool, you know, Italian household, dad hustled and, you know, worked real hard during my upbringing, and mom worked as well, but she was, you know, she was more of the healing hand. He was more of the authoritarian in the house. You know,
yeah.
Pretty typical. And when we moved out here, it was a change of school, but I was young, 6 years old, and I don't think I had any real issues adapting to, you know, the new environment, the new school, the new friends and things like that. I think things really started to turn for me around sixth grade, and I really don't know why, but that's when I started to be a little bit more rambunctious. I was a little bit more fond of pushing limits and getting into trouble and nothing serious, just really trying to see where the boundaries were, how far I could push people, teachers and you know, other authoritative figures. And, you know, it kind of just snowballed from there, to be
right.
honest with you. You know, it was just a matter of wanting to hang out with my friends more often and do the things that impressed them rather than do the things that impressed, you know, my parents and the teachers and things like that.
Right. But I mean, sixth grade is the perfect time for that kind of change in attitude, because you're like, what, 12, 13?
A little bit longer. I think probably 11 years old.
Yeah, yeah, something like that. It's like right in that age range, you know, after you, once you get past 10, 11 years old, you start growing your teeth, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And your social circle gets bigger. So now you're under the influence of of your peer group, I think, more than you're under the influence of your parents at that age.
Yeah, absolutely. So what did that look like? What kind of friends did you have?
I had good friends, and I think that, you know, we, just like all kids that age, generally push these limits together, right? See what you can get away with.
Sure.
Many of those friends I'm actually still friends with today. I've got one friend in particular that I've been really good friends with for about 35 years.
Wow.
And, you know, being 40 years old, and I pretty much grew up with him. You know, he does pretty well for himself, and, you know, all the other guys that I met along the way, we're older now, so we all have jobs and families and such, but, you know, growing up in the teens and the 20s and even in the early 30s, we spent a lot of time together. We were very, very friendly with each other. So, you know, pretty much just regular suburban, you know, school kids just doing what suburban school kids do, climb trees, throw rocks, you know, throwing snowballs at cars and things like that. So, you know, I don't think there was really anything atypical about our behavior at that point. But yeah, that was, you know, I'd say just typical kids doing typical things.
Your area? Because everybody's got their groups, you know, there's the skateboarders and the BMX guys and the, yeah, you know, the jean jacket with the patches crew, you know, there's yeah, all of those groups. Well, what was your group like?
I'd say my group was probably a combination of those two. We got into a lot of trouble doing those kinds of things. So, and I probably started smoking cigarettes when I was 13 or 14, whether or not I knew what I was doing is one thing, but, you know, we did things like that. I skated for a couple of years growing up. We, you know, hardcore and punk shows out here at that time were a pretty big thing. So whether they were, you know, local bands or bands just from, you know, the general region. So we did snowboarding and skateboarding and things like that, dirt bike riding, you know, skeet shooting, you know, stuff that we would do, I guess any really rural New Jersey kid would do out in the woods when there's really not much to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, when we got bored, I remember one summer we discovered fire, and that was a big problem. We almost set a forest on fire in Michigan, and it was, I mean, that would have been a problem.
Right.
But what are you going to do? I mean, that's what kids do. They do stuff like that.
They do. And, you know, I often look back. I had this conversation with a colleague of mine yesterday, and I couldn't help but wonder, like, how I actually lived to be 40. And I guess that's a parent's greatest challenge is, I mean, if you've got one job as a parent, it's to keep this thing alive until it's 18 years old.
Yeah.
While they try to do everything to keep that from happening. And I think I certainly made it hard for my parents. My friends certainly made it hard for their parents. But I don't know. That's just what kids do. You know, little boys do. We discovered fire and fireworks. I remember taping fireworks together and lighting them off to see what would happen. I remember, you know, starting fires and things like that. one particular, there was a development going in across the street from our house, New Jersey, and they had these hay bales in front of the drains to keep all the debris and stuff from going in. And I actually lit one of those hay bales on fire during, I think it was a Memorial Day barbecue at my parents' house. Fire department goes across the street. Everybody in the party had no idea what was going on except for me and my friend. I think it was actually the friend I mentioned before, Mike, you know, kind of looked at each other and knew right away what was going on. Now, fortunately, nothing else caught fire except for this bale of hay in the middle of the road. But, you know, that would have been a problem up here, too. It's a pretty wooded area. It would have been a mess. So is that where you are right now? You're in Michigan?
No, I'm in Denver now.
Okay. Okay. Now my wife and I actually vacationed in Denver or in Colorado Springs.
Yeah.
And I guess like most tourists do, it's beautiful out there.
Absolutely.
Absolutely beautiful out there. So, did you grow up out there or did you grow up really most of your childhood in Michigan?
Just most of my childhood in Michigan, really. Okay. I mean, that was my experience. I was born in Michigan and kind of grew up in a city called Saginaw, and it's okay. About you know, it's about an hour and a half from Detroit, about a half hour from Flint, and really high unemployment, really, really rough kind of area. But that's the thing. It's like when you sort of grow up in a rough area, and that's your experience, you don't really always know it. You know it sometimes,
sure.
Because you know which block is okay to walk down and which one isn't. But right. You're not afraid when you're on the good block, you know?
Right.
Like, right. You don't really think about it. That's just your experience. But now it's, you know, I've kind of moved past that, and it's gotten to the point where it's taken me a long time to get used to the fact that sometimes strangers just want to have a conversation and say hi, and they don't want any money. Like, you know, it's a weird thing. This was sort of a geographical cure for me in a lot of ways to come out to Denver. I've been here about 7 years now.
Okay. Now, what do you feel is the greatest difference between, I guess, people in Michigan and people in Denver? I mean, I've got my opinions on the people from New Jersey versus the people in Colorado, and it is a stark contrast to, you know, what I expected. I mean, to your point, I feel like wherever I go, I almost assume that it's like where I'm coming from.
Yes.
And when you get there, you realize that people aren't the same, and that, you know, New Jersey's known for certain things. You know, Colorado's known for certain things. Michigan's known for certain things, and then little micro areas within. So, what do you feel like is differentiates the type of people from Michigan and those in Colorado?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, and I think that the way I could qualify that best is to say, I think when you live in a place that has pretty intense winters,
mm-hmm.
and let's say it's not as economically thriving.
Okay,
those two factors will do something to you. I think it does something to the population and the way that you think about every transaction, every meeting, every moment of your day. And mm-hmm. it kind of seeps into you. And so I think that the differences between the two groups of people is in Michigan, I noticed that it's not that people aren't friendly, but there is a little bit of guardedness that comes with people. And they're a lot more guarded. They're a lot less open to try new things. And they're not really all that interested in doing things for the sake of doing things. It's more along the lines of, okay, but what's the purpose of this?
Right.
What do we gain from that? And
right, like a the question is survival in a way, whether it's food or safety or whatnot.
Totally. And that goes into your social aspects as well. It kind of all feeds into each other. And in Colorado, people seem to be a lot more laid back about just about everything.
Like,
it really doesn't matter.
Yeah. You know, and it's funny because I've seen and heard stories about people in Alaska, for that matter. And there's some of these villages in Alaska where, you know, the days are short, if at all. Obviously, it's cold up there. And, you know, alcoholism and alcohol and drug abuse are huge up there because, I mean, you're locked inside. You can't really go outside and play. You can't go outside and produce anything. You're really locked in your house. And, you know, I think we all understand that idle hands are the devil's workshop. And if you give me enough time in enough space and leave me by myself for long enough, you know, I'm one of two things are going to happen. You know, I'm going to come out with a Mona Lisa, or I'm going to come out with, you know, an awful lot of challenges that I just manufactured out of thin air.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That adversity can really breed some great art and some great, you know, great thought processes and stuff, but not always. I mean, sometimes it just creates cycles of depression and alcoholism, like you said, because that's the thing. When I moved out to Denver, that was one of the big things that I noticed is that people here drink a lot. Everybody thinks about Denver as a weed place, and it's got that too. But mostly, it's full of people who are high functioning alcoholics.
Okay.
But but what I mean by that is people who drink probably every other day, if not every day, but just socially.
Sure.
They have one or two and they stop. And I wasn't used to that. I was used to, if you're going to drink, you're going to do it until you don't remember.
Right, right. I've had pretty much how we grew up too. I mean, that was that point of drinking. It wasn't to loosen up and relax. It was to drink as much as you could. And the next time, hopefully try to drink a little bit more.
Right.
Now, what do you think? You know, that's interesting because it's almost like that there's little dependence on it for function.
Yeah.
Right? Just more so on the social component of it to, you know, loosen up, relax, talk, lower your inhibitions, have a more comfortable conversation. What do you think is the buoy that keeps that kind of, you know, drinking from sinking all the way down to the bottom and causing, you know, what could be terrible circumstances for some people? It almost seems like there's a force there that keeps it from getting that bad.
Yeah, I think it's ultimately that there's been a culture created here. Mm-hmm. And it's just part of the culture. In fact, I think that there's probably a lot of people that could do just fine. If the alcohol went away, they'd be fine. It's just part of the culture to have a couple of drinks. But it's also part of the culture to be outside, to be active, to go places. Mm-hmm. And that was another thing that was kind of, you know, head scratchy for me was, you know, to go to a public park and it's packed just because it's open, not because somebody's having a family gathering or something like that. It's packed just because that's what people want to do. They want to go outside. They want to be places. They want to see each other. They want to congregate. That's bananas to me.
You know, we went to recently New York. And New York's about 45 minutes east of us. And,
okay.
I appreciate the city. I like the city for what it is. I've been there a number of times, not so much very often, regrettably, you know, since 9/11 happened. I was old enough to remember that and be working when it happened. I've only been to the city once, well, twice since that happened. Once was briefly in town for a business meeting and only got to see Ground Zero for a few minutes. And for me, I felt like it wasn't long enough in a way. I'm kind of going off on a tangent here. It wasn't long enough for me to sit there and mourn because I remember it and I remember it well. And I think most people that do, you know, we never forget, like we will, you know, things get buried underneath the sands of time. And, but whenever I see the 9/11 TV series come on at or around that day, I tear up like it was yesterday, and I have a different appreciation for it now. Back then I was single. I lived on my own. Now I have a family. I've got kids. You know, every conversation you hear of people on the phones or, you know, stories of survivors or those that didn't make it resonate with me a little bit differently now. And I really wanted to go there and just be solemn and be silent and kind of take it all in and see what it would say to me. And unfortunately I was only able to do that for about 15 minutes, and it wasn't enough for me to get into that mind state that I wanted to get into. Anyway, the second time I went with my wife and my kids, and I forget what park it was that we were walking by, but it was a park, not Central Park or anything. It was just some small congregation area off to the side with some trees and some you know, swing sets and things like that.
Yeah,
and people went there, which is foreign to me living out where I live. Went there literally just to be with each other, to share each other's company, even if they were reading a book and this person was writing or this person was drawing and this person was just gathering in the sun. It's almost like the energy of just having people around you is enough to recharge, you know, some level of deficiencies that I think that we have. And as humans, we're social creatures. As humans, we need to be around people. We do. Why solitary confinement is really such a punishment, because you don't get any interaction. It's you're alone, not just in this cell, but in your world. And
yeah, completely.
Right. And when people have an opportunity to go out and just be around other people without literally no pretext set as to what the expectations are of everybody. You're not in a mall shopping. You know, you're not on the highway driving. You're literally just here for the sake of being next to something, next to somebody. And I think that there's power in that, right? And maybe that goes to your point of, you know, being locked in Michigan when the days are short and the weather sucks outside and what seems like it wasn't a great neighborhood. You know, you put yourself in this solitary confinement, self-imposed or not, it's still that stress that you were talking about.
Yeah.
Your body doesn't treat it any differently as it would if it was a fight or flight situation, I think.
No, completely. And I mean, that's why I think that you get a different kind of person from, you know, that sort of East Coast harsh weather environment. And I think that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
Because even if you're in a nice house, it's almost a golden cage. If it's, you know, 40 below and the snow is 3 feet high.
That's interesting to put it that way. That's, you know, and the cage is still a cage.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about this. Cause I mean, you're setting fires to hay bales and hanging out with your friends and things are going along just like any kid does. But then shortly thereafter, you become a teenager.
Yeah.
And things change.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that.
So when I got to be a teenager, seventh grade, eighth grade, I don't know if my problems in school precipitated a certain mindset or if a certain mindset precipitated problems in school. I'd imagine it's probably the latter because it's something that, you know, basically pervades an adolescence, you know, ethos or calculus and how they think about things, relationships, conversations, events, and so on. And I think back then, when I was 13 years old, this was 1992, which I like to think of a golden age. I mean, how old are you, if you don't mind my asking?
No, I'm 42, going on 43. So 1992 was my jam.
Yeah, you remember it.
Yeah,
there's really nothing like it. That was when good music, you know, the hair bands were gone and now we're getting into grunge and alternative. It was when we got away with a lot more back then in the 90s than kids do now. Back then you were allowed to go out until dark and then even a little bit after to come home and nobody freaked out. Now, and I see it now as a parent, I'm afraid to let my kids go out by the street because they're just,
right.
You know, even out here, they just might disappear, God forbid. So
it was a revolution then, without the internet. Yeah, is what 1992 was. It really was the Wild West in a lot of ways.
Can you imagine what it would have been like if we had the state of the internet now was the same back in, you know, 1990 to 1998? I think that, I couldn't imagine what kind of trouble we would get ourselves into. That. We had that resource, but that would have ended up spelling out for us.
Yeah.
So, you know, back in the 90s, we got away with a lot more. We got into more trouble. We were forgiven for getting into a little bit more trouble. It was just figured that that's how kids were, I think. And I think we were a little grittier, right? We're a little harder than, you know, the kids are now. And,
yeah.
You know, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I think people are very protective over what they have now. And, you know, back then they were too, but it was a little bit more of a component of, you know, self-governance, I think, at that point. We trusted people to be people. We trusted them to do the right thing. Now we realize we can't do that, so that's why perhaps things have changed. But back then, I had a rocky go in school. I got left back in eighth grade, which was a punch to the gut for me.
Yeah.
Especially in eighth grade because my friends, my peer group, were now going up into a new school. They were going to high school, and now I'm stuck with the kids that, you know, I was, for a period of time, I was at that age, you feel superior to them. You know, they were a grade younger than us. You know, we picked on them a little bit more and I didn't feel like I was thrown to the wolves. I just felt like I was demoted in a way. And
I completely get it. Yeah.
Right.
I was held back in sixth.
And that's a tough one too. Now, were you in middle school at sixth grade or were you in the same school as seventh and eighth graders?
The same school as seventh and eighth graders. So that was kind of a gut punch in a way because all of the people that had moved on, we're still passing each other in the hallways.
Right, right. You and you know, socially, I think that can be traumatic to a kid, especially in your case. you know, you're at the bottom. Now, your middle school start at sixth grade?
No, sixth, actually, seven, it was my parents, because we were in sort of a rough area, my parents decided that they were going to try to get me a good education in a Lutheran school. So I went to this Lutheran school that was a bunch of wealthier kids. And I was not. And they didn't let me forget that. And I was, you know, skateboards and punk rock, and that was not okay. And so I was getting eaten alive in this Lutheran school. And it was kindergarten all the way up to high school.
Okay.
So it was everybody. Right. So when I got held back, it was kind of obvious to everyone. Yeah. Here's this giant sixth grader, you know, and there was nothing I could do about it. You know, the other kids are, they looked, because, and I'm not even a giant person. I was a skinny little 5'9" but at the same time, everybody else was shorter than me. You know, it was like sixth grade was right at that time where people start changing and, you know, the puberty sets in and all that. And so here I am looking like, everybody's older brother.
And that probably reinforced some of their misguided perceptions about you. You know, if you're this kid in school and you stick out like a sore thumb for, you know, a few different reasons, then getting left back is, you know, that's certainly not a point in your favor when it comes to the way they manage their feelings about you and who this kid is. And, you know, he's from over there. He's from that side of town, or whatever the case is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Getting left back at that point, it's like, what are you doing here? You're not, you know, that, did you get the feeling that you just weren't one of them? Did they get the feeling that you just weren't one of us?
Oh, yeah. That was, I mean, that was definitely it. It was because I had made an attempt to fit in once. And I learned this. I guess I'm really glad that I learned this at a young age. It was painful at the time. But the attempt that I made to fit in was I actually had a girl come up to me and talk to me, saying, listen, you know, we've all been talking, and, you know, she was genuinely trying to help me. This is what it was. She said, you know, you stick out, you get beat up a lot. And that wouldn't happen if you would basically, conform to these things. So, here's a list of clothes that are okay for you to wear, and a place where you can get your hair cut.
And did she seriously give you a list?
Yeah, I seriously got a list. I wish I still had it. I wish to God I still had it. So I went to my folks and I was like, this is, and I rewrote the list myself. And I was like, this is what I want. And it was so different. And of course, my mom was really excited because it wasn't, you know, skateboard shoes and Dead Kennedys t-shirts. And so it was polo shirts and you know, K-Swiss shoes and all this. And I was going to try it. And, you know, my folks, they didn't have a lot of money. My dad was a jukebox repairman. And so we had records. So that was cool. But my mom was a receptionist somewhere. And I had three other siblings. And so it was like, we're just trying to make this work.
Sure.
So they, you know, they took me to the place and they got me the stuff and I tried it on and it felt false. Yeah. It didn't feel right. I looked in the mirror and I was like, this looks right.
Yeah, but it wasn't your skin.
Yeah, it just didn't feel right. But I wanted to try it out because I wanted to know what that felt like to fit in. And the thing that I found out right away was that I showed up to school and everybody was nice to me that day. They were like, oh my God, you look good today. What did you do? It was really weird the way they turned on a dime just by looking at me.
Did that tie your head in a knot? I mean, were you?
It did. Because on the one hand, it was kind of awesome to have people be nice to me for a change, and to not have to fight, because I was always ready to fight. just to defend myself. I was always ready for it, and I was terrible at it, but I could take a punch. Okay. So.
That's a good and a bad thing.
Yeah, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't, at that point, I wasn't smart enough to just run away.
Right.
But there I was, showing up in the clothes, I'm in the uniform of everybody else, and being treated nice, people are treating me different, they're talking to me different, and I did that for about a week, and I just couldn't do it anymore. Because I found it was making me very, very aware of just how much these people didn't like me.
Yeah.
And it just reinforced the fact that I was different, I was alone here, and that I had to change who I was and what I liked in order to fit in.
Now, did you come up with such a vivid realization of that at that age, or was it more of just an intuition that you had?
It was just an intuition. I mean, it was because I wasn't very self-actualized at that point. That was probably the beginning of my understanding that, this is who I'm not. Now let's figure out who I am.
Okay.
You know, it's a process. But then for you to go into a situation where you're left back in the eighth grade and you're not in the same school as the other kids. So in a way, do you think that was better or worse to be alone during that?
You know, I think at the time it was worse. I look back and there's really nothing I would change. There's really nothing that I would change about anything that I've done because I'm happy with where I am now.
Yeah.
Beautiful family, healthy kids, you know, a house that's got heat, hot water and electricity, reliable cars.
Yeah.
I don't know if I were to have changed one thing, you know, the butterfly effect from something that happened 26 years ago, if you're off just a little bit at that point, you know, 26 years later, that the difference between, you know, where you shot that arrow from and where it actually lands can be a much, much different place. So I think looking at me now, I don't think it really made much of a difference, or at least the difference that it did make was, I guess it would be inconsequential as long as I'm good with where I am now. But back then it was tough. You know, I had a decision to make. I was either going to assimilate into a group of kids that were essentially a second degree version of the group of kids that I was used to hanging out with, because these are kids that looked up to me, my friends, my peer group, my grade, and they got a lot of their cues from us.
Yeah.
You know, they wore the type of clothes that they wore because somebody that they looked up to wore them. They listened to the music that they listened to because somebody they looked up to listened to them. So I was either going to, for lack of a better expression, I was either going to downgrade into and fit nicely within this group of what I thought were subordinates in a way for up until that very point, or I was just going to really do my own thing, represent my peer group as a, you know, I was almost an ambassador kind of stuck here. And this is my job, is to now continue to make my group of friends, you know, reinforce whatever their thoughts were about them. And I think I took that road with it. Not that it was a ringleader or anything like that. These people had their own, they had their own cliques, they had their own friends, and because of the town that we grew up in, we were all really, I think, closer than a lot of towns were with different grades and different groups. We might have, you know, fought amongst each other, but whenever we were a guest in somebody else's party or in somebody else's town, it didn't matter if this was somebody that just punched you in the face yesterday. We were best friends until the next day at school when, our normal behaviors took over. So I don't think it was, I would have liked to have moved up. I don't think that being left back for the reasons they said I was left back were accurate. I was a smart kid. I passed all my tests. I just had a lackadaisical attitude about school. I didn't see the worth in it. I didn't see the value in it. And yeah. I was obstinate because of that, and a little bit spiteful in a way. And you know, cutting off my nose to spite my face. I think that was the perfect, I think probably metaphor of what my behavior, what really predicated a lot of my choices was, you know, well, I'm going to say no because I can, and I'll deal whatever the consequences are because they don't make a difference anyway.
Yeah.
And that piss poor attitude, I think, I mean, it's made me who I am now, and I kind of like having a vein of that in me.
Yeah.
It certainly didn't do me any favors growing up.
I'll admit to that too. I sort of think that there is a value to keeping some of that, just a little bit of that, you know, like a sure. vein, like you said, just keeping yeah. some of that in you. I don't know. I think it's healthy.
I agree. And listen, I mean, we're an amalgam of all the different people that we were up until right now, you know.
Sure.
And we turn different knobs depending on different situations. And when we identify where we are, who we are at this very moment, you know, I like to refer back to a lot of pieces to a lot of the people that I was previously, you know, a little bit punk rock, a little bit bad attitude, a little bit troublemaker, you know, I'm not very averse to risk. And
yeah.
I think that that's a good thing, as long as it's calculated. And, you know, now at this point I can understand what consequences are. What do I have to lose? But, you know, I don't usually have a problem betting it all on black, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that it's gotten me to where I am now, through my career and kind of just throwing the chips up in the air and letting them fall where they may. I always like doing that. For me, that abrupt change, if I wasn't quite happy with where I was, even to this day, it was a lot easier for me to, rather than make a small modification, just create a situation where I had to change a lot of things. You know, I'd rather than just move a chair in and out of a room, I'd rather just paint the whole thing and get, not that I do this, but I'd rather just rearrange everything, get new effects, get new things to decorate it with, and just call it something new. I feel like that, you know, 99% is as good as 0%. You know, when somebody wants yeah. to make a change, making a little bit of a change, I think, is worthless. You've got to do it all at once. So when I wasn't happy with my circumstances or my situation, you know, whether it was in a positive way or not, I would usually just, whether it was screw things up for myself just so I had to rebuild it, or if it was, you know, appealing to somebody else and saying, you know, I'm ready to be, you know, who I think I should be. Like, what do I have to do that? And totally letting myself become vulnerable to, you know, whatever things might happen that make me uncomfortable. I mean, you commit to that, right? And I think
yeah.
that we've all done that, whether it's starting a new job or moving to a new town and making new friends. I think that, you know, I've always enjoyed doing that in some weird and sometimes masochistic way.
Well, it does surprise a lot of people to see the way that you know, that kind of that kind of punk rock ethos, if you will, kind of mm-hmm. evolves into something that's really serviceable in your yeah. adulthood. That yeah. DIY nature of taking what's in front of you and being able to make a big swing, to be able to make a
yeah.
big change and a big choice, because you've gone through things to the point where you understand that failure is just failure. It's an option, and you can take another big swing next. You can get yeah. You can pick yourself up and you can move forward because you've been through something that's been difficult and came out the other side alive. So
yeah.
why not live with a little less fear and take some more chances? Why not?
Agreed. And I think if we evaluate ourselves and situations that we've been in, every time we thought that the world was coming to an end, it never came to an end. I mean, there might have
yeah.
been some discomfort and some modifications that we had to make, whether it's the way we think, the way we act, or you know, the way we approach certain situations. But, you know, I can think of a few times, you know, whether it was a breakup with a girlfriend that I dated for almost 10 years, you know, you don't envision a world after this, you know, this wasn't supposed to end because I didn't factor in, you know, a future, any kind of future with or without something. And it's at those moments that I think that, you know, in these moments of chaos that I think that order is born, right? You start picking out the pieces, putting the ones that you know you've got, you start putting them in a certain order, and then you build upon that as your foundation. I know that I've got friends that have been through some pretty serious tragedy where even talking to my wife about it, saying like, I don't know, you know, it takes an incredible amount of strength to be able to wake up every day. And looking now at some of these events that happened a few years ago, you know, things change, you know, and, and things do get buried underneath the sands of time. And as long as you can hold out for long enough after such a change or such a decision, you know, there is a new level of normalcy, and it's often a pretty good place. You know, no, I don't think, I mean, sure, there's situations where the hits just keep on coming, but if you can weather that storm, eventually you do build a new life. You do build a new calculus. You do change because you have to. You know, if you're plucked out of Colorado right now and dropped off in, you know, Wyoming, you know, you'd probably be all right.
Yeah.
You know, you'll have to make some changes, and, you know, you go through all the stages of grief, but, you know, at the very end of it, like, you're going to be all right. The universe has a funny way of making sure that all of your wishes come true, and they might not come true when you want them to, but they're always on time.
Yeah. You know? Well, the other piece of that too is that a lot of times what people don't realize is that we make awful wishes for ourselves and fulfill those wishes as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? I wonder why we do that. You know, I still to this day, I make choices, or I realize that I've made a choice and it wasn't a good choice. And if I were counseling somebody, if they were to say, hey, Matt, this is my situation, what should I do? I know damn well I wouldn't have told them to do what I just volunteered myself to do.
Yeah.
And I don't know why we do that. Maybe there is a piece of that, you know, let the chips fall where they may, left, or some sort of, you know, reckless self-destructive behavior is still left there. But it really doesn't matter, because even with that hiccup or with that wrinkle, you know, if enough time passes, it always ends up being inconsequential. It's never as bad as you think it is, as long as you can wait long enough to think about enough things in the meantime.
But all of this emotional intelligence doesn't just land on you. It's something that's learned through years and years of sometimes bad decisions just layered on top of each other. And instead of lamenting the bad decisions, beginning to piece them out and figure out where they went sideways and want genuinely to change. So, I mean, listening to you now, you definitely have that high level of emotional intelligence, that level of analytical thinking. But, I mean, that's not a naturally occurring phenomenon. So, where does that come from for you?
You know, I agree that it's learned. I think I would add to that it's also earned. You know, these are scars that we wear with pride. These are you know, events that we're happy to talk about because we made it to the other side
of
what we thought wasn't, you know, a traversable event. We thought that we didn't, not that we necessarily, or I necessarily thought that it would end here. I just didn't know what's on the other side of the black hole. You know,
right.
You just don't know. And in order to find out, you know, you've got to roll the dice. And I think that the emotional intelligence, I think, is a blessing and a curse for a lot of people. And I get the sense from you that you think a lot about things and the effect that they have had, the effects that they could have, and the effects that, you know, they most certainly will. And I think that I look at it more like it's an exercise, and that things are fun to think about, because I don't know if I'm the only one that feels this way, but I know that every time I've ever worried about anything, and it doesn't matter what it is, whether it was I was called into my boss's office for a conversation, or, you know, I got in trouble and I'm just waiting for my dad to come home to find out, get called to the principal's office, anything, a meeting, you know, a negotiation. Every single instance that I've worried about anything and I've created a situation in my head that I was sure was going to happen, 100% of the time, never ever happened the way that I pictured it. And I feel like there is some universal law that states that if you, simply by virtue of you thinking of something happening a certain way, you've eliminated it as a possibility.
Yeah.
Because I don't know, you've looked at it and you've, the wave function of this event has collapsed. It no longer becomes a possibility to whatever the situation is. So knowing that, I think that's given me a certain kind of faith where no matter what, I know I'm wrong. And I'm glad to know that I'm wrong about all of the terrible things that I've imagined in my head. So if, you know, I get called in and I know that I screwed up, or, you know, I know that I'm about to get reamed out for one reason or another, thinking of how it's going to go and then going into that conversation or that situation, it always ends up being different, if not better, than what I envisioned it being. So I can relax knowing that I've come up with all the worst case scenarios, and because of that, they just don't exist anymore. And now all that's left are, you know, the better ones.
Yeah.
So, you know, trying to think through it as much as I can, but almost in safe mode, where I know that nothing is going to be damaged by me thinking about it, because I turn off my stress, because there's nothing to be stressed about. You know, these things aren't going to happen. They're just not feasible any longer because I've identified them. So the more bad things I can think about and identify them, I could check all the boxes of all the things that are lowest on the list. And all that's left are, you know, things better than the worst things I thought of. So yeah, I think that the emotional intelligence, I think, comes with a certain degree of faith, knowing that nothing is ever as it seems, nothing is ever as bad as I think it will be, and that in the end, everything really ends up being okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could put yourself in any situation as a test and bet your ass that you're going to come out on the other side. That's a given.
Yeah.
So how bad could it really be? Not nearly as bad as you think it will.
Right, but how do you get there in the first place? Because it seems like people usually arrive at this this mountaintop after having been in a valley. So, I mean, what did that look like for you as far as developing a positive or workable mental state? Like, where was your bottom?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. So getting left back in eighth grade was really the beginning of it.
Yeah.
Freshman year, I got kicked out of school, high school freshman year. I was put on homebound instruction for a period of a few months, which is probably the worst thing that you can do to a kid that's got problems managing his energy.
Yeah.
Because now I've got a tutor that comes to my house for 2 hours twice a week. I'm not allowed in school. What else am I going to do with the 9 hours a day that I ordinarily would have been under, you know, the authority of somebody? My mom worked, my dad worked.
Right.
So got myself into trouble, you know, doing things that, you know, I shouldn't have been doing. When we reached the end of that road, we found an alternative school for me to go to. Incidentally, it's in the same town that I work in now. And that place, give it a shout out, Lafayette Learning Center. I don't know if it's around anymore.
Yeah.
But I remember that at the time that I was asked to leave the school, they were in the middle of contract negotiations. And I'll never forget this. I remember during that period of time, they had to suspend a football program at our high school because the teachers weren't under contract and the coach wasn't getting paid for it. So what they did was they suspended the program because there was nobody that would volunteer to coach the athletics program, or at least the football program at our high school. So I get kicked out. I go to a private alternative school where these teachers are getting paid nothing. They are getting paid garbage. They're the people they work with, the kids that they work for, are very misbehaved. They are very disrespectful. I mean, you know, we had fights in our high school, but nothing like the fights that we had at this school. I mean, the fights at this school were bloody. There was no, you know, there was no governor. These kids were just all on, and they would rumble, and it was no joke. So, you know, these teachers were putting themselves in harm's way, getting paid much, much less than the teachers in my original district would have even considered working for. But in there was a teacher. He was the history teacher. I remember staying after in school one day, walking by a classroom and seeing the history teacher. I wish I remembered his name. He was a great guy, sitting down, going over a history lesson with one of the kids who, as far as I was concerned, wasn't even worth it, because this kid wasn't going to make it another couple of years without, you know, either dying or going to jail.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the whole school kind of, you know who everybody is. But this teacher stayed after to try to make the influence, and he wasn't getting paid for it. And you've got somebody here trying to save one kid's life that he knew was probably not going to be successful. I hope he was.
Yeah.
And I'm contrasting that against the district where I came from, which had a lot of money in the school district. And because the teachers were bickering and arguing over a contract, this guy spited an entire football team and said, nope, sorry, not getting paid. I can't work. When he very well could have, because he already had the time to do it anyway.
Yeah.
So anyway, that gave me a realization that there's certainly a difference between educators and teachers, and that teachers show up just to do their job, and educators really do care about the future and the not just of the kids, but of kids. And that really resonated with me. And now that jaded me a little bit, because now I had nothing good to think about the teachers from the school that I had originally come from. So they went down another notch in my book. So went to that school. I met all my goals that they were set. They set them pretty lofty because they didn't want me to come back. I met my goals. I get let back in high school a couple of years later. And it was my senior year. I had my senior picture taken and I got kicked out again. And here I am, 17 years old as a senior, and sitting in the vice principal's office. And he says, you know, Matt, what are we supposed to do with you? We can't keep you here, you know, because of, you know, these reasons. And I asked him, I said, well, how many credits do I have so far? He said, well, you don't really have very many. I think he said it was like 71 or 72.
Yeah.
Okay, how many credits do I need to graduate? You need 179 to graduate. So to help me do the math, and we figured out that if I were to have stayed in school and passed every single class, it would have taken me an additional 3.5 years to earn enough credits to graduate high school. So I would have turned 21 in May and graduated in June. And I said, you know what? I've already taken Algebra 1 five times. I'm not taking it another three. I'm not going to pass it, that's for sure. So, you know, I'd rather just, you know, why don't I just sign myself out? So I dropped out of high school right then. And mom came and picked me up. She's like, what did you do now? I said, well, you know, the good news is I don't have to go back to school tomorrow. She's like, were you suspended? I said, not quite. I just dropped out of high school. And she lost her shit. She lost her mind.
Yeah.
And I had given her a pretty good run for her money up until that point. And, you know, I think that it was really disappointing for her. So I got my GED almost right away. But I didn't do anything with it for the next 3 or 4 years. I stayed home. I sold weed, like I guess all good kids do when they don't really have anything to do and they need money. They don't want to get a job. So
been there.
I paid all my bills, right? You know, and interestingly, about a year before, I had gotten 2 underage DUIs. Now, the charge is actually driving after underage drinking. So I wasn't arrested for driving drunk. I was arrested for drinking really under the age of 21. If I had blown over the legal limit, I would have been driving while intoxicated. But I got the same charge I would have gotten if they caught me drinking in the woods.
Yeah.
So got my first underage DUI. Before I went to court for that one, I got my second. So the interesting thing is that maximum penalty for that loss of license is 30 days because I'm not driving while intoxicated. So I go to court for the first one, lost my license for 15 days. 2 weeks later, I go to court for the second one. He's like, didn't I just see you in here? I said, yes, sir, you did. He's like, it's a shame I can't take your license away for longer, 30 days. So I lost my license for 14 days, but he threw every fine, every penalty at me that he could, and it racked up to quite a few $1,000s. So I had to pay it somehow. And, I ended up making my money that way. Now, there was a time, at that time, I was working out. We had a little gym set up in our basement, and I was working out in my basement. My mom one day came downstairs. She said, "Listen, I know what you do. You know that I know what you do, and that's not okay. So, you know, you work out every day. Why don't you see if you can get a job being a personal trainer?" And this was back in 1998, 1999. And I thought about it, and I said, you know what, I might as well. And I was very well self-educated. I always read, never fiction. It was always nonfiction, science, philosophy, theology. I like books that made me think, didn't just make me learn.
Yeah.
And, so for me, science was a natural marriage for me. So, I went and I bought my materials and I studied my ass off for the test, and, drove down to Blackwood, New Jersey to take the test at Camden County Community College. I thought I did well. I failed it by one question. And, when that happened, I knew that I had a choice to make. I could either say, screw it, this wasn't meant for me, or I could figure out or understand that I didn't really study as hard as I could. I didn't do as well as I knew I was able to. And I sat down and I gave it 100% and went back and I actually aced the test. So after I aced the test, I looked around for many jobs, found, I got an interview over at a Bally's in North Jersey, went for the interview. The interview went great. It was fantastic. Just need you to take this cup and go pee in it. And, I took the cup and just got in my car and drove home and said, all right, I'm going to have to look somewhere else. And, no hard drugs or anything like
right,
that.
Right. But,
you know, I knew I certainly wasn't going to pass the test. So, kept looking. Found a local place, local mom and pop shop and a big gym, and managed to get a job there. During the interview, for me, I was motivated by money, and I think most young kids are.
Yeah.
And I went and asked him, I said, so what's the most that a personal trainer has ever made here? And the PT director giggled at me and she said, why do you want to know? It's a ridiculous amount. You're never going to do it. And I said, well, how many sessions a week did they train? And she said, well, we do pay periods 2 weeks. It was something like 82 or 83 sessions in a pay period. Mm-hmm. Now, as a personal trainer, our personal trainers, 9 to 5 isn't 9 to 5. It's 5 to 9. You got clients that want to train at 5 in the morning and 7, 8 o'clock at night. Now, fortunately, I lived close enough to the gym where I could drive back and forth. I did end up sleeping in my car a lot because it ended up being you have a 7, 8, 9, a 2 or 3, a 4 or 5, and then a 9 o'clock at night. And I said yes to everything. I was the yes man. But anyway, after just 3 months, I had ended up breaking that record, setting a new record of just a couple of sessions more. My paycheck was ridiculous. And I said, you know what? If all I have is time, and I get paid for all I have, then I would make a pretty good amount of money. And I was getting paid well. So reinforced my yes man mentality. And within a few years, promoted to general manager, personal training director, sales director. After about 6.5 years, I found myself in a fortunate position to buy a minority share in the company. I did that. And 3 years later, left and decided I wanted to do something on my own. I don't know how much time we have. I mean, there's some interesting stories kind of buried in there as well. But
we have whatever you want.
So, all right. So, got married. So, I got turned down for the sales director job twice. My feeling was that it was nepotism. There was one of the managers there. Their spouse wanted the job. He managed restaurants. He didn't know anything about sales. I had proven that I can sell my ass off. And I got turned down for the job, got turned down for the job again, really started to lose faith in the whole thing, thinking that, like, this is my glass ceiling. I'm only ever going to be, you know, this personal trainer. And that upset me. So what I did really for one of the first times was I solicited some advice from the personal training director, who I ended up having a really good relationship with. And she told me, you know, listen, you can't, you were just too new here. They didn't really have a track record that they could reference as far as reliability and things like that. Even though you're great at sales, management's a different thing.
Yeah.
But go in there and just be honest. You know, the last two meetings, she was primary staff. She said the last two interviews you had with the primary staff, it just seemed too manufactured. It seemed too artificial. We could tell that you weren't comfortable. She said, and I know who you are, and who you were in those meetings and who you are two completely different people. So go in there and relax. And this way, at least, you know, if you didn't get the position, it was based on the merits of your qualifications and not on who they or who you want them to perceive you to be. So I went in and I promised myself I would relax and envision that I was talking to a group of friends that I knew for a long time. And after that meeting, I was offered the job. And for me, that was a huge victory. And that began establishing a track record of reliability and things like that. So when I had the opportunity to buy a portion of the company, I made the owner at the time an offer of which he declined. I don't think that he just wanted another iron in the fire. And then a couple of weeks later, and now I'm thinking, like, where can I go? Because again, here's this glass ceiling that I was just always afraid of. 2 weeks later, he came to me, he said, I'd like to reconsider your offer. And, you know, so we accepted it. Now I got some back end exposure to the whole thing. We had some differences in our opinion about things. I'm sure that, you know, he's got some pretty mean things to say about me. I've got some pretty mean things to say about him. But, you know, two sides to every story. There's two sides to his story. There's two sides to mine. Yeah, I'm not saying mine's probably any more reasonable than his, but probably equally.
But it's yours.
But it's mine, right? So, you know, anyway, I you know, ended up leaving there in quite an argument and kind of had the same conversation I had with my wife that I had with my mother 20 years prior. And that was driving on my way to work, had a phone call with my business partner on my way back home, pulling the driveway. My wife is still getting ready for work. She says, so what are you doing home from work? It's like, ah, let's just say that, you know, I get a little bit of time off. She's like, oh, why? Did so-and-so give you a vacation? I said, no, I just quit. She said, we got married a month ago and you just quit your job. Do you get your money back? Who's going to pay the mortgage and all that? And I said, I honestly have no idea. So there's one of those moments you throw the chips up in the air and, you know, you let them fall where they may. I know she wouldn't leave me. I knew that everything would be okay. I didn't know how, but it's often in those moments that you find yourself doing things that you, one, didn't think of before, or two, would never consider doing because it just, the circumstances didn't permit it. I realized at that point that I can work 18 or 20 hours a day because my only other choice was failure. And now this kingdom that I'm trying to build, this family that I'm trying to grow, you know, I'm a property owner. I would have to give all that back. And I did everything that it took. And I got my investment back, not a penny more. And it turns out that that was almost to the penny exactly how much I needed to open up the business that I have now on my own. And which kind of showed me that this was the right thing at the right time, that I had taken the right steps and had the right conversations with the right people, where this was just such a given. It was the perfect fit for this situation. This was meant to be. Not because I had hoped for it and I had prayed for it, you know, but because everything that I had done up until this point was not in vain, even though I felt like it may have been, because God gave me this thing that fit so well in my current circumstances. And I had to wait long enough for it, and I had to hope long enough for it that I had the opportunity to see this. So opened up my own business, and you know, 9 years later, here I am. You know, but to answer your question, I'm not sure where the turning point was in all of it. I think that my fear of failure was a very big driver, but also my mother, God rest her soul, I wanted to make her happy. And she was alive then. She's only passed away a few years ago. I wanted her to be proud of me, because I knew that she wasn't the day that I dropped out of school. And maybe it was because I knew that people had this perception of me being I want to say a bad kid, because I wasn't a bad kid, but, you know, a kid right. that made not great decisions. And, you know, I was known as the smoker and, you know, the troublemaker and this and that.
Sure. Yeah.
I needed somebody to prove wrong. And, you know, everybody needs a nemesis. Everybody needs somebody that they don't like, that they're working themselves away from. And I was working myself away from me being my own nemesis.
Yes.
I wanted to get away from that perception that I had of my, well, the fact that I could even picture that bothered me.
Yeah.
So I needed to get away from that. And the only way forward was a successful road. Otherwise I would end up just qualifying it. And I didn't want to do that.
Well, and being your own nemesis is perfect, because you can definitely see the kind of person that you have the potential to be. Because if you're honest with yourself, you know your own darkness, you know your own shortcomings, you know the ways that you're going to fuck yourself up, you know all of that. And nobody knows it better than you, because it's something that you can tell yourself when you hide it from the rest of the world. And to be able to take that and look at it as a measure of the person you could be, but for your own choices, is probably the best thing anybody can do for themselves. Because if you're strictly looking at yourself through the lens of a different person who you don't want to be, a different person who you're putting the measuring stick up to, you're not really looking at yourself. You're not really looking at your own behavior. And to be able to do that is probably going to get you some results. And I guess I'd also like to say that I think taking this idea of looking at yourself this way, investing in yourself this way with motivational actions, thoughts, and behaviors, it's got to be a more mentally stable way to exist, because you're not dealing with the fallout from incremental small little baby steps. I think baby steps can be damaging sometimes, because it gives you too much time to worry over things rather than taking action. And every minute you're not taking action that's in a positive direction is another one where you're still stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, they say that, at least I've heard that the definition of hell is on the day that you die, the person who you were meets the person that you could have been. And, you know, you wrap that up with, you know, how should you live your life? You start with your eulogy and you work your way backwards. And my biggest fear is, I know, and I think all of us do, what we're really capable of. And I think that we're afraid of the amount of work that it takes, because we think it's going to take way more than it does. And when I think of the person that I could be, in the sense of meeting the person that I could have been, I really, and it's not a fantasy. I know that I can be exactly who it is I want to be, no matter who that is. And it's just a matter of, what are you willing to invest and what are you willing to sacrifice?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I remember many days, like when I got that job at the first gym that I ever worked at as a trainer, I remember wanting to just be better and better and better at what I did, because that meant that I made more and more and more money. That was my measuring stick. So I remember Friday nights, I had to study for a new certification or a new credential. Friday night, all my friends are at the bar watching, you know, a friend of ours play, and I'm home studying. And one of the things I did when I first moved out into my first apartment, I promised myself I wouldn't get cable until I was done studying for something.
Yeah.
And so I had Bruce Lee, Enter the Dragon playing over and over and over in the DVD player. I know that movie word for a great movie. Anyway, I remember Enter the Dragon on, my phone just blowing up, and everybody's saying, yo, are you coming out to the bar? Jay's playing. Are you coming out to the bar? I said, no, I've got to study for it, you know, and in not so nice way, you know, come on, man, don't be such a bitch. Get out here, drink. It's only one time, you know, it just, you know, things that your friends would say. And I held strong. And I think that, you know, I sacrificed that night. I sacrificed those, you know, the fun that I would have had and everything else. And I did that often because my priority was to be better at everything that I did. And yeah. in order to, you know, break an omelet, in order to make an omelet, you got to break a few eggs. So I did that. But I think that you really have to, you've got to realize that you're going to give some things up, and rather than enumerate them, you pick a point on the horizon and you trudge for it. And, you know, things are going to fall to the wayside. You're going to lose friends. You're going to lose other opportunity. But I mean, really, it's a matter of what's most important to you.
Yeah.
And to me, it was, you know, it was running from that unsuccessful, disappointing, troublemaking kid that had no ambition, you know, and I knew that I needed to find what drove me.
Yeah.
And that's what drove me.
Yeah. I haven't seen my PlayStation as much as I would like. Yeah. But it's because I'm busy doing other things that are more important. And it's there once in a while when I need it.
It's not the same, is it?
No, not at all. It's I actually kind of love the fact that the little things, like getting out on a skateboard, playing my PlayStation, things like that are now sort of, you know, rare treasures that, you know, I'm going to take a couple hours today and I'm just going to play video games for a while. Just shut it all off. And then now back to work, back to what needs to get done. Because at the end of the day, when I think about my previous month, you know, where I was, what did I accomplish and what can I look at? You know, those things matter to me a lot more than, you know, did I beat this level? You know, I honestly don't care about that anymore. I think I'm using it appropriately.
Yeah.
Rather than as, you know, a time suck that makes me forget about what I'm not getting accomplished, what I'm not doing with my life, because it's pretty easy to distract yourself from the things that you're unhappy with rather than change them.
So how do you define and how do you measure success?
The way that I would define success and the way I would measure it is, for me, it's very much in line with what you had said about starting with your eulogy. Success for me is knowing that I've been a good person, or at least, you know, I died that way.
Right.
Because I didn't start that way. But knowing that I was able to be a decent human being, and that I left the world, or, you know, let's even just say the week. I left the week with an output of creative something that I can look back at and point at. I feel like I was successful at communicating. I was successful at doing something with my time that I can now look at and say, this has value. So for me, that's what it's all about. It's all about using my time to either amass experiences or to create. That's really the most valuable thing there is for me, because the experiences are what are going to enrich my life. Not things, not stuff, not shows I watched on TV. It's experiences with other human beings or out in the world or with my own two hands. That's that's invaluable. You can't do anything to get that other than to go do it. Right. You can't manufacture it out of nothing. Right. But to have read a good book that makes me think differently, that's a personal change that's a positive thing to record some songs, make some music, and be able to look at that at the end of the day and say, when I'm gone, this is me spray painting my name on the wall.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I did with my life. Do I feel good with what I did with the time that I had? That's success.
That's awesome. So do you feel that if the person, when you die, you meeting the person you could have been, do you think that you're going to be looking in the mirror when you meet that person? Or do you feel like...
No, I think it's going to be, I think I'm going to look at that person and I'm going to go, I was close.
I think that's fair. I think that that's as much as you could hope for.
Yeah, I think that's my best case scenario.
Okay.
I'm going to look at that guy and I'm going to feel okay with it. I'm going to go, I was close. I tried and the effort wasn't in vain.
Now, where do you draw your strength from? Where, like, when you feel like you're feeling down or you look at your week that just happened and you're trying to measure your success and you maybe didn't hit the mark.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we're having a bad day and you just feel like you feel down on yourself. What are your bootstraps? Where do you draw your strength from?
I think that it basically just comes from, it just comes from having been a survivor. Mm-hmm. and being able to look at some, like if I look back on a week that was a complete wash, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't perform, I let depression get the better of me or something. And mm-hmm. it was just like, I was doing the bare minimum to get by, you know, wake up, go to work, shower, you know, I can eat, I can take care of what needs to be done, but that's it. You know, I've had those weeks, but, you know, I'm able to take a look at that and say, all right, that was that. And now it's time to move on because all I have is who am I going to show up as today? Mm-hmm. Who am I going to be today? Because the world is completely indifferent to my action or inaction. Now, who am I going to be? And that's ultimately what it comes down to. And so when I really need some bootstraps, I basically just decide, do something. It doesn't matter what it is, but do something. Because if you can't be enthusiastic, manufacture some enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Exercise is great for that. 'Cause mm-hmm. it gets the endorphins going. And you start seeing change.
Yeah.
When you exercise, you can see physical change. You can, you know, weightlifting helps, running helps. I'm a big fan of that. So, I mean, I know that there's tools in the toolbox that'll help, but, otherwise it's basically just the fact that knowing that going through all of the things that I've been through, that, you know, surviving myself at my worst.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to find myself in a situation where I feel like if I lost all of my money and I lost all of my stuff and I was put in the middle of nowhere, you know, no therapist, no medication, no money, no phone, no resources. Could I survive? Could mm-hmm. could I find a way, to work and get some food? Could I find a way to build myself back up to where I am now? I'm a believer that the answer to that is yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I could. And that takes a lot of the fear component out of it. So my bootstraps don't have to be as strong as they used to when I was just afraid of things.
Right.
So my bootstraps are not much these days because I know that just determination and movement in some direction is going to carry me forward.
Well, they say that motion creates emotion.
Yeah.
Right. And a rolling stone gathers no moss. So, and I find myself getting stuck too. Sometimes, you know, getting stuck to my chair. You know, 1 minute I'm looking up a video on exercise, on YouTube about exercise, you know, 20 minutes later, I'm watching a giraffe give birth and I'm fascinated by it. And I find myself totally, how did I end up here? And I'm watching just one video after another. And I have a voice in my head that just says, stand up. Just stand up. And I stand up and I say, okay, now walk. And I go and I find myself in the kitchen making a snack, or I find myself going to the bathroom. It doesn't matter. I've changed my trajectory.
Right? Yes.
I've created some kind of momentum. Now, for me, I've kind of got that voice programmed in there to work when I need it. Now, when you know you've got a toolbox that you can refer to when you feel like you lack enthusiasm, what would you say to somebody that has a toolbox that's full of everything that they need and it's right next to them, but they just can't open it, or they don't want to open it? And it's not because they enjoy what they're feeling at that moment. It's just they lack the ability to decide to do that. I mean, what would you say to somebody like that?
That's, I've been there. I've absolutely been there. So I think that there's a couple of things that you can say about that. I think that there are certainly times when you can allow yourself to sit if it's necessary. If you can't do it today, you know what? Maybe take the day. But if you can, reach for something, anything at all, and do it. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. Pick up a piece of paper and see how many times you can fill that piece of paper with a smiley face. How many can you fit on this piece of paper? It's action. It's giving yourself a duplicatable goal that is designed to produce a result. Because the great thing about the human brain is you will get the same endorphin rush crossing your laundry off the to-do list as you will buying a brand new car. And so to be able to just take a small action of, I'm going to fill this page with squiggles, it's going to do something to your brain. It's going to wake it up a little bit. It might not wake you up all the way, but it's going to wake you up a little bit. That's what I would tell somebody who's having trouble. Start small and feel good about that small, and then we'll work up from there.
I think that's brilliant. I think that's probably going to be my greatest takeaway from this conversation. I think that's brilliant. Now, I know somebody that has been having some problems lately. They feel like they've been alienated. They feel like, in some cases, they feel like they've been kind of just left out to dry. And my take on it has always been like, listen, you know, people have shit they have to do. People have jobs, people have families. Nobody's going to the bar anymore to hang out. So it's not that people don't want to hang out with you. It's just that people have so many other responsibilities baked into what their day is.
And
you know, the greater your meta responsibilities are, the greater uncertainty lies beneath in terms of things. You know, you have a baby and you don't really factor into that how much time you have to spend feeding the baby, cleaning up after the baby, changing the baby's diaper. You know, forget that you've got to spend an hour and a half trying to put this thing to sleep. So in that, there's just all these things that take more time, and it's hard for somebody to commit to, you know, hanging out with you if they have so many other big things. Like it's really got to be a perfect scenario. And I try to tell this person that, you know, it's nothing personal. And if you need something, there are a million people out there that'll give it to you. But if you want something, there's a lot of other things that this person just needs to do.
Yes.
So, and now they beat themselves up over it pretty bad in ways that concern me. And they really do concern me in a very big way. Because you don't really know where their line is drawn when they bury themselves underneath all of these kinds of emotions. So how would you suggest to me, what would be how can I be more empathetic to this person, and how could I successfully or more successfully manage that without wondering if, you know, I haven't heard from this person in a day and a half, now I'm starting to worry about them. How do I improve their perception of the way that things are when they can't get out of their own head?
Well, there's a handful of things involved in mm-hmm. that. So we'll go through that handful. Okay. We'll pull the mixed nuts out of the can and we'll just go through them. So, I mean, where we would be on something like that is, for one, you have to recognize that human beings are a big bag of conditioning and years of beliefs and behaviors that a lot of times are even just unconscious. Like, this is just how I operate. This is just how I am. Unless you're a person who's genuinely thinking about, you know, why you do the things you do. I think a lot of people don't think about why they do the things they do. And I'm not saying that's necessarily good or bad. It's just a neutral fact. Mm-hmm. And so what I would say in a case like this is, this sounds like a person who's struggled with some things over the years, but maybe hasn't taken a look at the ownership of their role in things. You know, it can be difficult sometimes for people to see their place in the universe as something they have an active role in. They see themselves as passive. Things happen to them, and they react. This happened to me. They left me behind. The boss didn't give me the promotion. They forgot my sandwich shouldn't have had onions. You know, it's like, it, rather than saying, and this is what I did about it, it's right. This is what happened to me. So being able to get yourself in a place where you recognize this is the reality of the situation. Now, who am I going to be? Who am I going to show up as? That's a difficult thing to parse after years and years of conditioning. But the thing I will say about your part of it, the part that you have control over, especially when you want to be more empathetic to someone who's having a hard time, the first thing to do is, when they tell you what they're experiencing, believe them. Because whether it's rational or not, it's happening. That's their reality. And so the first thing you can do is believe them, that they feel that way, that they're experiencing it. You don't have to agree with it. You just have to believe it. You just have to believe that they believe it and they're feeling it and they acknowledge it. And that, gotcha. I think that when you take that tack with a person and you let them know that you see them and you see what they're going through, you see how they feel about it, and you believe that they feel that way, it reframes the way you'll interact with that conversation, just naturally. Mm-hmm. Because now you're like, all right, so if this is our reality and this is where we're starting from, what do we do? How can I help? Rather than saying, because when you tell somebody the sky's not purple, they don't want to hear it.
You can argue with it. Yeah.
So it's a process, and it can be difficult. It can be really difficult, especially if it's a person you care about. I mean, I got friends that I care about that, you know, they haven't quite reached that point of figuring out how they're going to navigate their own pitfalls that they seem to like to put themselves in. And you can't really do it for them. You can offer suggestions. It's always helpful. Yeah. And you never know what's going to stick. But ultimately, just come at it from a place of understanding and empathy. And that's it. Because that's the only thing you can do. If that person is someone that you're concerned that their actions Like if they're, if you think they might be self-destructive in any way, whether it be, let's say, even just, you know, get hammered and, you know, puke in a fountain somewhere, or if you think they're going to, you know, they're really going to try and take the parachute. It's, it's never a bad idea to just check in and just say, hey, what's up? Was thinking about you. Or, hey, remember that weird dog we saw that day? I was thinking about that. Good times. Busy today, but catch you later.
Yeah.
It's never a bad idea to just check in and say, hey, I remember you.
Right. Now, so let me ask you this. Now that very well might help with the maintenance of, you know, their current state or their current level. It may, it'll help to not let them get any lower.
Yeah.
But what can I do to help bring them up? Right. Because I know that my feedback, my input will be helpful. But if they've got a woe is me attitude, or they feel like, you know, it is them against the world, then there's going to be a number of other different stimuli between that and the next time I talk to them that might bring them back down to the same place or maybe even lower.
Yeah.
So is there a way that I can help them recognize or help them to recognize like who they really are? And they're just stuck in this, you know, this bottomless pit, you know, where we can get lost in our own heads. We can convince ourselves of anything.
Yeah.
And if we don't pay attention to it, you know, it's this water is going to, it's going to stagnate and it's, you know, it's going to spoil.
Yeah.
So how do I, or how would you suggest that I help them move the ball forward as opposed to just not contributing to the ball moving back?
The first thing that I would say to that is the thing that nobody wants to hear, which is maybe you can't.
Okay.
And you have to make peace with the idea that maybe you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Because quite frankly, you can be a positive force. You can be helpful. You can even have the answers.
Yeah.
You can't make them change.
Right.
You can't. And you can't make that your job. For one, it puts a strain on friendships. It's a heartbreaker. And I think the best thing that you could do in a case like this is absolutely be there. Absolutely have a toolbox of things and suggestions at the ready. Because ultimately, for one, that it's going to make you feel better to know that you're able to help if they want it.
Right.
But ultimately, you have to really separate yourself from the responsibility of them making this change. But the way that I would say is a good way to, let's say, cross the bridge over into making an attempt at helping somebody who seems like they're not really even sure if they want it, is to not tell them some things they can do, but ask them questions that they then have to answer. Because again, you have to think about what it is you're doing and what it is you could be doing differently versus what you're being told to do differently and what you're being told is different. Right. So if you start asking someone questions about if someone has a negative experience with something, and you ask them, even something as stupid as, you know, why do you think that happened?
Mm.
And do you think you could have reacted differently to that? No, why not? Yes, how? Why didn't you? Like asking those questions makes the person think about their behavior and then actually have to answer the question, like, yeah, why didn't I think differently about that? Why am I upset about this? Why does this bother me? I mean, you can go down the rabbit hole until they're like, you know what? Just leave me alone. But still, it's ultimately that is really the key to it, I think, is asking questions and then making them answer those questions about how they feel, why they reacted the way they did, why they think this is the reality, and how they could change that reality if they wanted to. But those are all questions. You know, none of those are a statement.
So what I, it's funny because what I, the way that I interpret that, and I think that that's brilliant, the way that I interpret that is that rather than serve as their counsel, you suggest that I serve as their conscience in a way.
Yeah, in a way.
Right, where I'm not, you know, offering suggestions because the voice in our head wouldn't necessarily do that. Where what I do is I help them think through it aloud.
Yeah.
Where I know that, like, I've got a voice in my head. I've got probably more than a couple.
Yeah.
And over the years, that voice has transformed. Interesting. Because I remember at certain points in my life, the voice in my head wasn't necessarily telling me to do negative things, but it was dragging me down and bringing me into a dark place, and not a violent place or a threatening place, but really more self-threatening, I think. And it was a self-deprecating voice, and it was a challenge for me to dispel that voice. And I've managed to do it. I don't remember when I managed to do it, but I do remember when it shifted. I remember when the coin flipped and I had this new voice in my head that was more positive. It wasn't a why, it was a why not.
And, yes.
Right?
Yes.
And it really, and I don't know why it happened, but I certainly know that it did. And there are moments where I'd still hear the old voice, but now it's literally just a drop in the bucket and it's inconsequential. It's scary because I recognize it, and I recognize it too well.
Yeah.
But I don't recognize it well enough anymore to manufacture it. So I can't put it there if it's not there. But every now and again, I don't know, maybe, you know, the stars align in a certain way where I do hear it and it scares me because I remember that I hated it.
Yeah.
And it rarely does it appear, but when it does, it disappears quite quickly. The voice I have in my head, and I don't know if it's an amalgam of the people that I model myself after, but now the voice in my head is a more positive one that brings me into a better place. It brings me into an area of lightness and not an area of darkness. And so when you suggested that, it made sense to me because they're obviously appealing to me for something. They feel like I do have an answer or an outlet or something to offer. If they're calling me and I'm the one on the list now that gets the call, and you know, they bring up all this shit that I don't want to deal with right now, but it's here, it's in front of me. They did it because they want, even though they might want to vent or they might want to tell me what they're feeling or what they're thinking, they're calling me because they're hoping I have an answer.
Yeah.
And I don't, because in order for me to have an answer, I would have to have had every single experience and every single conversation and every thought that they've ever had.
Yeah.
And since I haven't.
Good luck with that.
Well, right. Exactly. Right. Any suggestion that I could offer to such an intelligent person, they would know right away that it's disingenuous and it's just an effort to make this conversation as short as it could be.
Yeah.
And in that, that's just another reason for them to lament, another reason for them to feel the way that they feel. Where rather, if they called me and I could actually serve as the voice in their head to drown out the other voice and ask the whys, you know, why do you think that happened? How did that make you feel? You know, what would you do the next time or whatever it is? I think that's really the takeaway that I get from that is don't be the counsel, be the conscience.
Yeah.
And I think
completely
that's huge. I didn't expect you to be able to answer my question with all due respect, but I think that you answered it better than I think you think you did. That's awesome.
Well, I appreciate that. And, I think, honestly, before I fuck it up and say something stupid, this is a great place to end.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Thanks for talking to me today.
Hey, I really enjoyed this conversation. I don't know if it's ever your intention to have your guest walk away with a tremendous amount of information, but more so for the audience. But this has certainly changed me, and I'm glad that I was able not just to ask those questions, but to get such a satisfactory answer from it that, you know, I don't know. I'm sure somebody out in that listens to you has somebody that they have had the same experience as I have had. And I hope that that also answers their question. But man, I really enjoyed this. I really appreciate your time. And I'm glad that you do what you do.
Thank you. Thank you.
No,
I enjoyed this too.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much.
And there we have it. You made it all the way to the end here. If you want to get some more Scarfo in your life, and I know you do, you can find him all over the place, including LinkedIn, Instagram, and Patch.com. Look for user Matthew-Scarfo, and you'll find him. There are links to those articles in the feed below. Just scroll down. Take a look at the feed. As for me, coming up on the 21st of October, you can come see me as a guest performer on the We Still Like You show at the Bunt Pork Theater Company in Denver, Colorado. It's going to be a great show. Tickets are going fast. You're going to want to get them, and I would love to see your smiling faces there. Besides, what else are you going to do? And until then, don't kill yourselves out there.